Hello and welcome to the Patreon ad-free early edition of the Deathcast. We're getting into the third and final episode of the Wonderland Crimes. I'd like to thank my patrons, Channel and Anthony. I hope you guys have enjoyed my coverage of this case, and if there's any aspect of it you feel inclined to, you want to discuss, feel free to open it up in the comments underneath this post. Alright, all of that's out of the way. Get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, we talked about how detectives had gone up to Oregon in an effort to try and track down John Holmes and his girlfriend, Dawn Schiller, and how that really had not led to them discovering where Holmes was at. However, they did encounter Dawn Schiller's family, and as you're going to see, they play a much larger part in this case than many people who are aware of the case even know. Not long after returning back to Los Angeles, the detectives were really at a dead end. They didn't know what to do, so on a whim, they decided to reach back out to Dawn's family, specifically to her younger brother, Wayne. And they did this for a number of reasons. One, they thought that he was a trustworthy individual. Two, he made it fairly clear that he wanted to get his sister away from John Holmes, and that's because Dawn Schiller had a very troubled upbringing. I'm not going to go into all of the things that she encountered while growing up. You can actually go out and find her book on dawnschiller.com and read all about it, as well as her life with John Holmes and really how he groomed her when she was underage and targeted her. He also had gotten her involved in drugs and forced her into prostitution in order to pay off his drug debts and for them to pay for drugs. I believe I spoke about it in the first episode. One of the individuals that he pimped Dawn out to was Eddie Nash, and he did this on at least two occasions that I'm aware of, knowing that Eddie Nash was an absolutely horrible, horrible human being, and that he used women like pieces of tissue paper. The stories I've heard of this man leaving, you know, bathrooms without toilet paper and then offering girls drugs if they'll lick him clean after he uses the bathroom, turning around and girls who wouldn't do what he wanted, getting hooked on drugs and then ending up working in some of the worst whorehouses in California, really just doing everything that he could to degrade women. She had to experience some of this stuff because of Holmes, and it was because of this reason that Dawn's younger brother was more than willing to help the detectives locate her sister and Holmes. Now, the detectives explained to Wayne that being in the presence of Holmes could very well be a dangerous situation for Dawn, as they believed that sooner or later Eddie Nash was going to decide that the drug-addled John Holmes, with his knowledge of the crime at Wonderland, was too much of a liability to be allowed to walk around, and would more likely than not have Holmes murdered as well as anybody else who was with him, namely Dawn. It was during these conversations with Wayne that he offered up that the family had recently received two collect phone calls from Dawn, originating in the Dade County area of Florida. Armed with this knowledge, two of the officers, Officer Tom Lang and his partner, Detective Tomlinson, decide that they're going to fly to Florida and see if they can't sniff out Holmes and Schiller, and Wayne agrees to meet them in Florida. And the reason that Lang and Tomlinson had decided that they were going to go down to Florida is because Lang's partner on this case, Detective Souza, he had begun to build something of a rapport with Susan Lanius, and it was decided that because of the injury she had suffered, the amount of traumatic brain injury, and just the overall trauma she had gone through, it would be best for their case if they kept the same officer with her, talking to her, rather than possibly cause her more trauma or distrust by changing it out and sending somebody else over to speak with her. So Sousa's gonna stay behind while Lang and Tomlinson head to Dade County. And they arrived in Miami on November 30th of 1981 after speaking with officers in the area who agreed to cooperate in any way they could. They set about meeting up with Wayne on December 1st. Wayne took them to the home of an old family friend. And when I say old family friend, the Schillers had lived in Dade County for a number of years prior to moving to California. And it was Wayne's belief that Dawn most likely would have sought them out in that area. So they drop Wayne off at the Smith's home, and then they proceed to a local real estate agency where they had traced one of Dawn's collect phone calls to. Unfortunately, nobody inside of this real estate agent knew anything about the phone call at that time. With little to go on and no word from Wayne, they decide to head back to the Surfside Police Department. There was a lot of your standard police work. The officers from Los Angeles gave the Metro Dade County homicide investigators their thoughts on a case that they were working on, and through a local drug enforcement agency agent, they were able to hook up with another detective by the name of Bob Richardson, where eventually, through numerous twists and turns, the officers end up involved with the Miami-Dade Vice Squad, talking to various informants. They receive word from Wayne Schiller that the Smiths had in fact seen his sister Dawn. He gave them a line about having run away from Oregon and being in the area only long enough so that he could see his sister. They learned that Dawn had been in the presence of another young woman who worked at a local topless bar. It was learned that Dawn was living with this woman and taking care of her children. Something seemed off about this situation, so the Smiths had watched Dawn and this woman leave. Taking note of the vehicle that they were driving with, it was a blue Ford pickup truck with a camper bed on the back of the truck, which they noted as resembling a log cabin. That evening, officers learned that this truck had been located in the parking lot of a local topless bar establishment, and they decided to go and stake it out, and sure enough, they found the truck in the parking lot, and Lang and Tomlinson decided to go inside of the bar separately in order to scope the scene and see if they could make the woman who had been seen in the presence of Dawn Schiller. Well, Officer Bob Richardson waited outside for them in the car. This was basically in case the woman driving the vehicle tried to make a break for it. There was a possibility that one of them could stay on her. Eventually, they see this woman and she leaves. The officers decide to follow her, and she nearly loses them. This was at roughly 3 o'clock in the morning. Again, the officers almost lost the driver of this truck, but they were eventually able to, with Richardson's help, find it again and track the vehicle back to a house. After the woman went inside this building, the officers took note of the address before deciding to call it a night. Now, the next day, they go and pick up Wayne. Now, the plan was to bring Wayne over to the home where they believed Dawn was staying at, and to get Wayne to go inside and see if he couldn't coerce her to come out, and this is what they go and do. Unfortunately, after nearly an hour, Wayne comes out unsuccessful. Wayne leaves the home the detectives follow, and they find out that Dawn can't leave until 4:30 that afternoon because she's watching this woman's children. They also learn that Dawn claimed not to have seen Holmes for about 2 weeks. They end up going back to pick Dawn up, and Wayne is driving with his sister. They stop to pick up beer, and eventually during this drive, he breaks the news to her of, hey, I'm here because your boyfriend's a wanted man, and I'm trying to get you away from him, and I've got the police with me. Eventually, Wayne pulls over, and the officers approach the car, and they begin speaking with Dawn, and by the officers' accounts, she's fairly standoffish at first, but she listens to them as they explain the fact that Holmes has gotten them both into some pretty deep water, and that these threats that are being bandied about in the underworld in Los Angeles are very real, and that because of Eddie Nash's drug ties, it is very, very possible that he could reach out to where they are in Dade County and have the two of them killed. Dawn eventually cracks and lets the cops know that Holmes is at a place called the Fountainhead Motel on Collins Avenue, staying in room 41 under the name of John Wade, and that he is working at the motel as a maintenance person. He's also dyed his hair black. So by that night, there's 8 detectives converging on the Fountainhead Motel. And Dawn had given them enough information about Holmes that they realized he was not a fighter. He was a chicken at heart. So instead of raiding the place and trying to take him into custody, they would just wait it out and see if they could make him. And eventually they do this as Holmes is going from his hotel room into another. And it was actually Lang who ends up nabbing Holmes as he's lying on his back, shirtless on the bed, with Lang pointing his gun at him. According to Lang, Holmes said something to the effect of, "I was wondering when you guys would show up. What took you so long?" Amazingly, Holmes ends up not fighting extradition, and the following week agrees to head back to Los Angeles, informing the cops that he had nothing to do with the killings and that it was, in fact, Eddie Nash who was responsible for all of it. Now, according to the officers, on their way back to headquarters in Los Angeles, Holmes mentioned to Frank Tomlinson, who's one of the detectives, that he had seen him reading his Bible and asked if he would pray with him. This is an important part, and I'm not saying I don't believe the detectives, but there is no way to verify what happens next. Apparently, when they get back to the precinct, Holmes and Tomlinson go into a room together. There's no recordings made of this. And it's during this point in time that John Holmes confesses to his part in the murders. More specifically, Holmes alluded to allowing the killers into the house. Holmes told them a lot of important information, except the key point was Eddie Nash involved and who had actually carried out the killings. Holmes refused to divulge this information as he said he feared for both his life and the life of his family. And it's at this point that John Holmes is officially arrested for his part in the Wonderland murders. And this was instantly all over the local news, as while Holmes was not known nationally as they like to depict him as being in films within the Hollywood area, Los Angeles. The name of John Holmes was very well known. Holmes ends up being charged with 4 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder. In January of 1982, Holmes is officially arraigned on these charges, and it's important to note that the officers were still working the case at this point, as they really wanted to get Eddie Nash. One of the conversations officers had while Holmes is sitting in jail after he's been arraigned was to speak with David Lind again, and they asked Lind whether or not Holmes had been at the Wonderland house often. Lind said yes, he was there almost every day, and then corroborated the fact that Holmes was not allowed upstairs or in any of the bedrooms, stating that Holmes, most of the time, was bringing stuff over to the members of the Wonderland gang to trade for his drugs. It's through all of this that they come to a couple by the name of Harold Glickman and his wife, Dottie. Harold had been in prison. He was a bail bondsman. He claimed his wife had stolen hundreds of thousands of dollars from his business, hooked up with Eddie Nash before ending that relationship and getting involved with a biker. They didn't get a whole lot of information from the Glickmans, unfortunately, but they ended up helping to feed back into all of the nonsense involving the DEA agent and his stool pigeons in prison, who were really all trying to protect their own asses, but at the same time, keep the police away from Eddie Nash. One of the individuals who was involved with Eddie Nash that the cops end up encountering is Scott Thorsten, who, as mentioned last episode, was Liberace's lover. He had a serious drug problem, was in and out of prisons. He ends up coming to the attention of the police as he was a frequent visitor to Nash's home. And eventually, he's going to end up testifying against Nash. But at this point in time, this is when they first learn of him and start hearing that he might know something. And the officers are really in a race against time here with Nash, because he's got a federal arson case hanging over his head. Now, he's going to end up not being found guilty in that case, but at this point, the officers did not know that, and they feared that if Nash ends up going to federal prison, there's a pretty good chance we might not be able to try him for some period of time for these Wonderland murders. So with Holmes going to trial, their bet is that they're going to be able to get Holmes to flip if they can either convict him or offer him a deal before conviction. Nash ends up getting charged on felony narcotics and assault charges along with Dials and Ammon Bashalon, who, if you remember, was the reputed head of the Israeli mafia. Now, Dials is going to get convicted on these charges, at least on the assault charge, which he's going to end up getting 3 years for in March of 1982. On May 18th, 1982, the trial of Eddie Nash and others began, and eventually he's going to be found not guilty for these crimes, as the stool pigeons that the federal prosecutors had really had no information to tie Nash to any of the buildings that had been burned. These were the same ones who had been in contact with officers off and on throughout the investigation. Later turned out they were pretty much doing this at the behest of a DEA agent. Now, John Holmes's trial began on June 3rd, 1982, and everyone you can think of testified at Holmes's trial, from David Lind to Susan Launius to the officers who had investigated the case. During the cross-examination of Susan Lanius, which was said to be handled with kid's gloves, the defense attorneys were able to get her to admit that at no point during the attacks had she seen or witnessed John Holmes in the residence. The flip side of that was that they had John Holmes' handprint on the headboard of the Lanius bed, which I described earlier as they basically saw it as the only way he could have been standing there like that was if he was bracing himself and striking at something that was down below him. At one point during the trial, Eddie Nash made an appearance and basically just sat in the back of the courtroom before leaving. The defense called no witnesses, and in their closing arguments basically stated that John Holmes had nothing to do with these crimes, and that the individual who was responsible, whom he didn't name, was out there walking the streets right at that moment. Holmes ends up being found not guilty for these crimes. Not long after this, Holmes ends up getting served with a subpoena by the Los Angeles County grand jury to testify at a closed-door grand jury hearing on what he knew about the Laurel Canyon murder suspects. Holmes refuses and ends up being jailed. So after Holmes eventually is released from jail due to pressure from Hustler and other media outlets, many people assume that the Wonderland murders simply went cold. That is not the case, however. Anyone who's familiar with Los Angeles County during the 1980s, with the introduction of crack cocaine, knows that there was a massive boom in homicides and violent crimes within the county during that decade that would not taper off until well into the 90s. So while the officers continued to work this case, they were not able to obviously give it their full attention as they had in the past. And somewhere in all of this, Eddie Nash ends up going on trial for the narcotic and assault charges. And the story that's out there is that at some point during this trial, Eddie Nash approached the officers and offered them money to make everything go away. The officers discussed whether or not they should approach Nash after he left to see if that offer was still good, at which point they could get him for attempted bribery, but they eventually dismissed this, believing that Nash was too cunning to succumb to something like that. On November 6, 1982, Eddie Nash was convicted on 7 counts of possession of controlled substances with intent to distribute. He ends up getting sentenced to the maximum under the law at that time, which was 8 years, although Eddie Nash would not end up serving the 8 years. And the officers continued to work this case as they were able to, still trying to get individuals who would give them the names of the actual killers and pin this thing on Eddie Nash. And it's at this point, roughly 83, that Henry Hoskins went to the police and stated that there was something going on with the case involving the Wonderland murders. If you'll remember, Hoskins was the DEA agent who had approached the officers early on in the investigation to try and get all of their information on Eddie Nash, which they refused. So now Hoskins is returning the favor by trying to get the man discredited. He claimed that his informants and his information was telling him that these detectives who were working the Wonderland case were in fact running cover for Eddie Nash, and that one of his informants, an individual by the name of Jerry Van Horlberg, had given him this information. This Jerry character was one of the informants who had tried to pass information on to the cops, one of the stooges, and who had been a witness at the trial of Eddie Nash for arson. This guy is in Hoskins' back pocket, pretty much. These guys are spinning the story that Dottie Glickman had been the driver of the murder, And basically, this is just a complete smokescreen in order to cause problems for these individuals and further protect Nash, while Hoskins is also getting back at these men. Nothing is going to end up coming of these allegations from Hoskins, obviously. And after a lot of legal wrangling, when the officers are informed of these accusations made against them, they get basically their union reps involved, and all of this is taken care of. But they begin to suspect that maybe Hoskins was responsible for the intelligence reports that had been found under Eddie Nash's bed. Never able to prove it, however, it should be noted that Hoskins ended up resigning not too terribly long after all of this happened and opening up his own private investigation firm in Los Angeles. As for Eddie Nash, he ends up getting a doctor to say that he has a severe sinus infection that it needs to be operated on, and they don't believe he can get the proper medical treatment in prison, so they appeal to the judge who originally sentenced him, and Nash ends up getting resentenced to 4 years. Now, there are stories floating around out there that there may have been a major payoff in the tune of $100,000+ to secure Nash his shortened prison term. Whether they're true or not, I cannot say, but it does speak volumes to the fact of the stories out there about Nash and his political connections. John Holmes continues on doing his thing. His life continues to crumble, revolving around drugs. He remains within the porn industry. And by 1985, give or take, he has a new girlfriend, a pornographic actress. I've read many statements about this particular late relationship. It seems more likely than not that this was more of a caretaker-type relationship than it was, you know, an actual marriage where love was involved. Because, see, John Holmes had begun working in pornographic films as his career crashed. His heavy use of narcotics began to affect his performance in front of the camera, meaning that he was not able to get or maintain a full erection, which obviously his claim to fame, because it wasn't his looks, was that John Holmes was extremely well endowed. Because of this, his overall unreliability and the stories that were floating around about him being involved in a murder and, you know, just the plain fact that he was a scumbag, the industry really didn't want to have anything to do with him, so Holmes had to take work working in pornographic films, and it's believed that it was through his work in these films that Holmes ends up contracting HIV, which I believe eventually turned into full-blown AIDS. For my younger listeners out there, I want to explain this, but I want to say it delicately. When the AIDS epidemic first swept America and the world, it struck the gay community before it struck any other parts of society that we know of. There were a lot of jokes going around at the time that I'm not going to repeat on this show because I don't want to drive listeners away by repeating that type of thing, but it did strike the gay community first, and it is because of the fact that it struck the gay community first that many believe that that is where John Holmes contracted the disease that was eventually going to take his life. So at this point in the story, he's really going to become a non-entity, and we're going to be focusing on the continued investigation of Eddie Nash. Detectives eventually tracked him down to a veterans hospital where Holmes stated to them in the presence of his wife that, you know, he might be willing to talk to them, but he would need to think it over, and they left believing that he never would tell them anything. Not long after this, on March 13th, 1988, John C. Holmes died from complications from the HIV virus at the age of 43. And it's at this point, again, that Scott Thorsten comes into the story, and he ends up contacting Tom Lang, the detective still working this case, to let him know that he wants to talk to him. And he does this through a deputy because Thorsten is still dealing with his drug habits and is at this point in jail. And the story that Thorsten goes on to relate to the police is that he had been at Nash's home on the night the murders had taken place. He claimed that he was heavily under the influence at the time, and that also present were Greg Dillis and Eddie Nash and John Holmes. Thorsten stated that Nash had Holmes beaten fairly severely, and that during this, Holmes began to cry before admitting his complicity in the robbery. At which point, Dials ends up putting Thorsten in a bedroom and told him not to leave. Thorsten stated, basically, from the bedroom, he heard others come to the house and then Eddie Nash yelling things about how he wanted them tonight and that they all needed to die and to kill all of those cocksuckers. He also stated that there were two other individuals present in the house at this time, one of whom's name was Johnny, although he did not know the man's last name and he knew no information on the other man. The officers tell Thorsten that basically, they don't know if anything's ever going to come of it, but they have his statement now. On September 7th, 1988, in a coordinated maneuver by the Los Angeles County Police Department, Eddie Nash was arrested and officially charged with the Wonderland murder, specifically orchestrating them. Also arrested was Greg Dills. Nash ends up going through a number of lawyers during the opening phases of his trial. Preliminary hearing takes place on February 6th of 1989 when they both enter not guilty pleas, with the actual trial itself beginning on March 20th of 1989. It was an unusual trial as Nash was being tried for orchestrating the murders while Dials was being charged for actually carrying them out. So they had two juries, and when evidence would be presented about one defendant that had nothing to do with the others, that defendant's jury would leave, meaning, hypothetically, if Scott Thorsten is on the stand, his testimony involves both Nash and Dials, so both juries are in the room. However, if, you know, somebody else is up there, say Susan Launius, and she's only testifying about what happened at the house itself, then Eddie Nash's jury would not be in the room. And here's another aspect of the trial that later came under scrutiny. They noticed during the trial that one of the jurors, a woman by the name of Shantae Taylor, was disinterested in the goings-on. And this woman happened to be on Eddie Nash's jury. On May 10th, 1990, the case against Eddie Nash ends up going to the jury, while the case against Greg Diles continues on. On May 15th, the jury foreman informs the judge that one of the jurors is refusing to participate or discuss the case with any of the other jurists. Now, the judge could have put in an alternate. He instead allowed Ms. Taylor to stay in her position, and this resulted in a mistrial. And the same thing happens in the Greg Diles trial. That wasn't the end of this case, because the state of California goes after Nash again in 1990. On January 17th, 1991, Nash and Diles were acquitted of these murders. This was because the defense introduced an individual by the name of Paul Kelly, who they claimed had actually been responsible for the murders. And these jurors believed this after the fact. Two jurors came forward and stated they believed that Kelly should have been on trial for these crimes. Now, he's been acquitted of it. The state of California can't go after Nash any longer, but that doesn't mean they're not still looking into him. But not only is the state of California looking into Nash, so is the federal government. In 1999, the federal government went after Eddie Nash with a RICO indictment for drugs distribution. However, they also went after him for the Wonderland murders. Now, Nash was not going to be retried for these murders, but instead would be tried for aiding and abetting in the conspiracy to have these murders committed. There was more in this RICO indictment, however. Bribery of a jury in the state of California murder trial being one of them, as it was found that Shantae Taylor had been bribed to not pursue anything against Eddie Nash, along with bribery of witnesses. It was learned concerning Shantae Taylor that Greg Diles had been placed in general population while he was in lockup and had come into contact with a Rolling 30s Crip member, whose sister happened to be Shantae, and because they really wanted to stick it to the police department, they concocted the scheme of having her paid off. So on May 19th of 2000, Eddie Nash is officially arrested again. So Nash ends up getting out on bail for $1.5 million, before being put back into jail for violating the conditions of his release. This time around would be different. Eddie Nash was much older. He was suffering from legitimate medical problems. He didn't want to go to trial. So on September 11th of 2001, Eddie Nash pleads guilty. According to Nash's lawyer, quote, "Nash had sent some people to get his property back. That's it." Nash ends up getting sentenced to 37 years of confinement. Nash does end up getting out of prison. He doesn't serve his whole time because of the medical problems he had, which I believe was emphysema. And Eddie Nash ends up dying at the age of 85 on August 9th, 2014. And I can't say it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Unfortunately, he was able to live as long as he did, having done the things that he did. The officers who investigated Nash took copious notes and told stories about Eddie Nash that, again, I will not reiterate here on the podcast, but you can find some of them online. Basically, Eddie Nash would find some young women, flash some money around, some drugs, get them to come back to his lair, and get them hooked on drugs. And once they were hooked on drugs, and once he had them hooked on drugs, they were his to use and dispose of as he saw fit. And the stories out there indicate that there are many, many hundreds of these women who were abused by Eddie Nash in his desire to debase them as human beings. But more than that, everything I have ever encountered about this guy, he was just the absolute fucking worst of the worst as far as human being goes. And it's a shame that he was able to use his power and his influence to get away with the things that he did for so long. Not only the lives that he destroyed through, you know, his drug trade, but also the murders that he orchestrated having done. And there may be more murders that Eddie Nash was linked to that we'll never know. So we are at the end of this week's episode. I hope that you guys have enjoyed me going through this case. Have a safe and happy new year, and thank you again so much for being patrons of the Deathcast. Until next time, stay morbid.